Bon, alors pour le séminaire d'aujourd'hui, j'ai le grand plaisir d'accueillir mon ami et collègue Marcelo Rosenberg. Donc Marcelo, c'est une histoire qui remonte à il y a longtemps, puisque il a fait sa thèse à l'université Rutgers avec Gabi Kotlian, très peu de temps après les premiers développements autour de la théorie du champ moyen dynamique. Il a été un des tout premiers à explorer la transition de Mott en utilisant cette théorie. Donc c'était sa thèse de PhD à Rutgers. Ensuite, Marcelo est venu à Paris pour un postdoc à l'École normale avec une combinaison linéaire de Werner Kraut et de moi-même. Il est ensuite allé à l'ILL, à Grenoble, où il est resté plusieurs années dans le groupe de Philippe Nozière. Ensuite, il est parti en Argentine, où il est toujours professeur à l'Université de Buenos Aires. Non, c'est fini. Pendant longtemps, il était professeur à l'Université de Buenos Aires. Aux alentours des années 2000, il est revenu en France, où il a obtenu un poste de directeur de recherche au CNRS, au laboratoire de physique des solides d'Orsay, où il est toujours à ce jour, sauf cette année, où il est en visite à l'Université de San Diego. Marcelo a travaillé sur beaucoup, beaucoup de sujets liés aux fortes corrélations électroniques. Et en particulier, il a été vraiment un des pionniers qui s'est intéressé très tôt, en collaboration avec son collègue japonais Inoue, aux mémoires résistives dont il a fait les premières modélisations théoriques. Et donc je lui ai demandé de venir nous parler dans le séminaire de ce phénomène de mémoire résistive, resistive switching, RRAMS, et en particulier les développements récents qui émulent, je dirais, des circuits de type synapse connectés les unes aux autres en utilisant ce type de dispositif. Voilà, donc j'ai un grand plaisir à accueillir Marcelo aujourd'hui et je lui laisse la parole.
Bonjour tout le monde, vous m'entendez bien? Ok, donc merci beaucoup Antoine pour l'opportunité de venir faire un séminaire ici et aussi de vous parler de quelques sujets qui sont un peu excentrés dans le mainstream de les méthodes de transition, mais vous allez voir qu'il y a plein de points en commun avec les choses qu'on connaît bien. Et tout ça a commencé en 2003, et effectivement, et pendant un séjour à l'école polytechnique avant de rejoindre l'EPS, et c'était dans le groupe d'Antoine à Alix. Maintenant, je vais passer à l'anglais, parce que pour la science, malgré le fait que je suis là depuis plus de 15 ans, et je me trouve toujours beaucoup plus à l'aise pour parler en anglais des sciences, mais bien sûr, si vous voulez poser des questions en français, ça ne pose pas de problème si vous me comprenez bien. OK, so I'll start with the talk. And this is the first transparency. It's a needed one. What is resistive switching in transition metal oxides? And this is a sudden change in resistance, not resistivity, but resistance, due to a strong electric stress, which could be current, could be voltage. So there are two types of changes that you can think of. One is a permanent change. That is what we call non-volatile. And this one can be reversible. So if you have a non-volatile change, which is also reversible, there's obvious applications, as electronic memories, because you can store the state of a memory in the value of the resistance. So this goes by the name of RRAMs, or resistive RRAMs, or oxide RRAMs, or membristols. These are all the same thing. And the other possibility is that the change is non-permanent. That is what we call volatile. That is, you apply a strong voltage stress, and the system changes the memory, but then when you stop the application of the voltage, the system comes back to the previous state. So that is a volatile change. So this phenomena has less obvious applications. And as I'll try to illustrate today, they are practical realizations of both artificial synapses in the case of the non-volatile changes and artificial neurons, as will be the second part of the talk when I'll describe the non-permanent volatile changes. So you can think of this in the context of the present course as new and rather unexpected functionalities of transition metal oxides.
Yes. You have made the difference. Can you recall the difference between resistive and resistance?
Resistance is the resistance that you measure. Resistivity is the intrinsic property of a solid. But if the solid is not totally homogeneous, then in your system, there may be different contributions in different states.
Resistivity is local and resistance is
Resistivity is the intrinsic property. And resistance is associated to the device. Okay, so I wanted to make that. Okay, so neuromorphic circuits and neuromorphic computation is a very hot topic. This is reflected by the fact that there are large funding projects, for instance, the Synapse project by DARPA in the US and the Human Brain Project, which is a flagship program of the European Union. Also, you know that Facebook and Google, big companies, invest a large amount of money in also artificial intelligence. So the latest or most recent developments, the dramatic developments in this area, follow basically two strategies. One is to push standard hardware based on silicon conventional hardware to the very state of the art and get chips which are already designed to capture neuromorphic circuits. On the other hand, developments have also been remarkable along the software. In software, you just implement neuromorphic circuits through code into standard computers. So you take a standard computer, the one that you have on your desktop, and then you implement a code of a neural network. So these ideas go back to the 90s and even before, and the modern case is these deep neural networks, which I could talk about, but basically, these are very well, very dramatically improve their performance, in particular if you have a Facebook, when you upload an image, a photo, it will start asking you, recognizing the people in the photo. So that is quite amazing. And this is done by this convolutional neural networks or deep neural networks, where you see that these systems have this layer structure where you have these round things represents neurons which are interconnected by these lines which are called the synapses or the neural weights. So you have pre-neurons and post-neurons connected by synaptic waves. Now, there is a problem with these two approaches, which is in order to try to aim to something like the human brain is quite a bit of a challenge because the human brain has 10 to the 11 neurons and 10 to the 15 connections. So how to cram that into a brain? So you cannot do it here. You need several transistors in order to represent a single neuron. So the circuit does not allow you even for the problem of power consumption. And the same here. You cannot implement so many neurons in a memory of your computer. So how about a totally disruptive technology and try to mix the two things and get the best of the two worlds. So that is realized here, at least conceptually. So you have here two neurons, which are the round things in the previous view graph, and then they are connected by a synapse. In biology, you have a preneuron and a postneuron. The preneuron is acting on the postneuron through the synapse. It sends a spike down their axon, and it's received by the second neuron, and it's modulated by the value of the synapse. So if we want to represent that in our context, we can think of one unit here, which represents the neuron, which does a very simple process. It starts to fire if it gets to some threshold level, and then it sends information down the link to the other neuron, and this information is moduled by a synapse. And this is where your memories get stored. So this is the non-volatile part of it. you can recall things that happened in your infancy. So this is stored in between the synaptic connections between the neurons. So we'll see that you can see that you need two types of devices. One is this very non-linear processing unit, which is the neuron and can send spikes down the connection, and then the spikes get modulated by some link which has a permanent value of the resistance, but nevertheless can be modulated. That's why we can learn, we can change our synapses, we can store new information in our brains through the modulation of the synaptic connection. So the RRAM, that is the non-volatile systems, will play the role of the synaptic connection. And the volatile, as I'll show in the second part of the lecture, will play the role of a neuron. So these two can be an important piece of information, is that in order to really achieve this high density with a so massive amount of neurons and connections, can be implemented through what is called the crossbar array. So since the here you have one pre-neuron and then another post-neuron, and they are connected through this matrix system, so the synapses stay at every link, at every crossing point of this array. So you see that you can solve the problem of the large connectivity in the sense that one neuron can be connected to many, many, many neurons, and with modern electronics, one can envision to stack these things three-dimensionally, so to make a system very, very, very compact. So the idea will be just that with oxides, we can realize these two new components, this neuron and the synapse. And this, I'll try to convince you, is a great opportunity for oxide electronics, in particular, transition metal oxides. OK, so let's start with the first part, non-volatile resistive switching. This is rather well established and started more than 10 years ago. So I'm going to go through the basic concepts. I'm going to describe the physical mechanism, and I will illustrate that with a simple model that we develop, and to illustrate what theories can add to this highly applied field. Okay, so resistive switching is not new. It began more than 50 years ago. And these are the initial papers in the 60s, and you see even pictures from an oscilloscope, very, very, very much before the modern color plots. So experiments in resistive switching imply a switching. So you apply voltage spikes, and what you see is that every time after an action, you'll see a spike of voltage as a function of time. You see a corresponding spike of current. Now, the interesting thing is that when you go to the low voltage, the bias voltage, and you probe the system, you see that the system, after the spikes, remains in one of two well-reproducible states, a high current and a low current, which amounts to a high resistance and a low resistance state of the system. You can do switching. And if you want to implement a memory, of course, you have strong hysteresis effects. So you can also investigate a system by plotting what is called the IV characteristics. So here is current, and here is voltage. This is a linear scale. And you see how the system can switch from a high current, low resistive state dramatically to a low current, high resistive state. And you can try to plot this in semi-log or log-log plots in order to investigate what are the physical mechanisms of conduction in these systems. I will say much more about that. And this thing was sort of reviewed in the beginning of the 2000s. Here are some of the initial reports. This comes from Bednor's group in IBM, and this from Alex Ignacek's group in Houston, which were the main players in the beginning of all this. So how typical RRAM systems look like? Well, they are typically, but not always, made of thin films by PLD techniques. And the dramatic advances of PLD techniques is something that opened the way for these investigations that started some 15, 20 years ago. And systems have some electrodes So this is like a capacitor-like structure where all the action is here in the transition metal oxide. So you have electrodes, which could be gold, platinum, very ordinary metals. One of the astonishing aspects is that the transition metal oxide can be a huge variety of systems, ranging from very complex multi-element manganites, even the cuprates work, strontium titanate, which is a very actively researched system right now. It could be the basic of oxide electronics, and then a large variety of binary systems work as well. I'm going to show some examples of this later on. And typical systems are 100 nanometers, which make quite easy to put strong electric fields by a moderate value of the applied voltage. So for the implementation of these systems, what are the key issues? Because, you know, semiconductor industry is a very well-established and very performing industry. They are very conservative, but at the same time, you have Moore's law, which probably will reach its limit in 2020 with the 5-nanometer devices, and we are almost there with 7-nanometer devices already announced. So, and you know that beyond that, you are left without any material. So the properties are you cannot follow the same route, so something new has to be done, but you have to show that at least it's competitive with whatever we have already now. So these are not all, but some of the main features that you may worry about: the endurance, retentivity, resistance on-off ratio, power dissipation is an important factor, and the commutation speed. So I'm going to illustrate some of the resistive switching experiments by addressing these features. And for instance, this is already 10 years ago, nickel oxide. In a nickel oxide system, you see high endurance. You have resistance change on and off, set and reset is also called. And this is the number of cycles. So you see 10 to the 8 cycles, and you have over a magnitude ratio without degradation. So you can see that you can switch the system many, 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 many times. High retentivity is something also quite important, because you don't want your pictures to go away. If you want to have a non-volatile memory, you want to that remains for years and not go to your USB key and everything is lost. So here you see this is hours, 10,000 hours, which is basically 8 months. And you see the resistive change remains there quite stable. Now, that is something to keep in the back of your mind. That is what is called the voltage time dilemma. You want to switch the system very fast in nanoseconds, like modern electronics, but then you want your memory to remain like that for ages. So how can you achieve a very, very fast change and then keep your memory in the same system for such a long time? Then the power consumption here, you see this is microamps, and this is IV curve. So there is the voltage, and you have the low resistive, the high resistive state with low current here, and this is the high resistive, the high current branch with low resistance there, and you see the very fast switching, and this can be controlled by low resistance, etc. The point here is that you can have systems with pretty low power consumption, and the power consumption basically is to switch a system and then to read it, but you don't need to spend power refreshing it. So this is a more recent work, and this is in hafnium oxide, so this is another transition metal oxide, and you see something of the state of the art. You see that the change in the resistance is also over an order of magnitude. The commutation speed is on the nanosecond regime. So here you have 5 nanoseconds pulses and a 1.8 volt application. So these are quite a reasonable values and very competitive nanoseconds. And then this thing has a huge endurance of 10 billion cycles. So very good for all the properties, and this thing is really starting to hit the market if it has not done it yet. but we worry about the physics. So how about the physical mechanism? How this whole magic seems to work? And one of the important issues is what about this voltage time dilemma? How can you get this system to switch so fast? So in order to try to gain insight into the physical mechanism, one thing to realize that I mentioned very briefly is the astonishing universality of this phenomenon for transition metal oxides. So this is a table of elements by Wong, where he showed all the binary oxide system, just the binary, that can exhibit resistive switching. So you see there are 3D, 4D, 5Ds, lots of transition metals, and mixed with oxygen in a binary mixture, it will work. You can use for electrode all these systems from titanium, ruthenium, gold, silver, many, many, many systems. And besides that, you have also ternary compounds, quaternary compounds, and even more complex manganites that I mentioned before. So clearly, this is universal. It cannot depend on the details. So what is some universal feature of transition metal oxides? And clear is oxygen. And then it's not surprising that oxygen vacancies have been observed to be involved in all these systems. This is there are lots of reports. This is something. This is one that I particularly like. So here you have this, again, this capacitor-like structure with the top electrode, the bottom electrode, and the transition metal. In this case, it's titanium oxide. So there you have yet another compound. So this is TO2 sitting in between the two electrodes. And this is in blue there. You have the top view of the titanium electrode, of the titanium oxide dielectric. And then here, this is the top electrode. So this is the top view. The bottom electrode, you don't see. You just see the top electrode. So you apply voltage on this one. And after a while, what you start to observe, if you keep on applying voltage, that bubbles appear beneath the electrode. So these bubbles start bubbling there. And there is a video on the web that you can watch. And you see these bubbles like if it will be boiling. So it's quite amazing. And this is the oxygen coming out of the system. Of course, probably here you totally destroy your sample, but clearly puts in evidence that oxygen is playing a big role and you can move oxygen in your system. The fact that you can move oxygen is precisely because, as Antoine has emphasized, oxygen grabs electrons from the transition metal to control the valence. And then once it is charged with electrons, then you apply a field and you can move the oxygens, or conversely, the oxygen vacancies. Very good. But not all systems behave in the same manner. So this is the first evidence that there are different systematic behavior. So if you take a binary oxide, like the one I mentioned before, you'll see that the resistance as a function of the area, this is the systematic behavior, is rather flat. While in another system, which is a perovskite, STO is a cubic perovskite, you see that the resistance in the on and off states go as an inverse law with the area. So this tells you that this is an homogeneous effect throughout the whole sample proportional to the area. But in this case, what this result is telling you, that is independent of the area, that all the conduction is dominated by a very well localized region of your system. So there seems to be two modes of work. So let's consider one. This is a copper oxide. So you see yet another system. It's a binary oxide. This is one where a filamentary or area-independent behavior is observed. And what you see is that you can switch your system from high resistance to low resistance. And this you can do by either polarity. You can go from this is a low resistance down to high resistance by applying positive voltage, or you can do the same thing by applying negative voltage. So this behavior is independent of the polarity. So if one may expect that filaments are behind the thing, one can set out to look for filaments. So you see here on-off switching many, many times and quite reproducible. And this is in a planar form, in a planar geometry. So if there are filaments, you may hope to observe them. So this is a copper oxide seen from the top. And these are the two electrodes, platinum and platinum. And when you apply a strong voltage, what you see is that you form the system. So the system is initially very, very insulating. You have to apply a very strong voltage. Presumably, you make oxygen move, as in the bubbles that I showed before. And after that, the system works. So nobody knows very, very well what happens through the forming. In any case, if you look at it, what you see is that there is a filamentary structure going from one electrode to the other. If you tune if you pattern the electrode like here and you make a protuberance there, you can sort of find your filament right there. And you can pattern in different ways and you get a filament right there. So you can get control on where will the system form the filament. Now, if you switch and you look again there, you would expect, well, the filament would blown up or something like that. But nothing happens. You look at it, nothing changed. So you say, what happened there? So this is a work we've done in collaboration with Ide Takagi when he was still in Tokyo. And they have here the form filament, the low resistive state. And what they've done is just cut it physically with a FIB. So this is not a black stripe that we drew on the image. They really went there and with the FIB, this is like a gap. It's a cut in the system. It's dark because there is no reflection from there. And when you cut it, what you see is that the system goes from the low resistive state to the high resistive state. So clearly the bridge is doing something. And then when you reform it, again with a high voltage pulse, what you see is that this thing reconnects through the side. Of course, cannot go through this wrench. It has to go through the side. And it reconnects and goes back to a low resistive state, very similar to the one before. Now, if you look at this system and you try to gain some information, you do resistance as a function of temperature, which will reveal what is going on. And what you see is that in the low resistive state, you have metallic resistance, while in the high resistive state, you have insulated resistance with activated behavior. This is 1 by T. So in one case, it's an insulator. In the other case, it's a metal. Now, I also mentioned that oxygen moves around quite a bit. But then copper oxide is particularly interesting because all combinations of copper oxides always give insulators. All oxides of copper in various forms, CO, CO2, and other varieties, they're always insulators. So if this thing is a metal, the only possibility is that copper had made a connection. And that is consistent with the fact that if you assume this to be pure copper, then the resistance of this should be much, much, much lower. So since there is copper going through this filament, you can work out from the resistivity of copper and find out that copper inside here, it's really making a nano-size filament. So this is 1 micron. And what I'm telling you here is that you are 3 orders of magnitude thinner filaments living inside that melted crystal. So that also explains why you can sort of have a high endurance. You can just switch on and off many, many, many times because actually where all the action occurs is at a nano size where you cannot see in these filaments. So you can get insight on the phenomenon from this point of view as well. So now the physics of this is rather simple. You have filament formation at the nanoscale. And then when you pass a current, that you create by a strong voltage, so you get the oxygen migration. When oxygen goes away, you're left with some copper. There is nothing else. And once you have your filament of copper very, very thin, you pass a current, and then you blow the thin filament of copper. The same way as the older people will remember in the fuses in the homes were just a very thin threads of copper. So whenever somebody made a short circuit, the thin filament of copper was blown out. Same thing happens here. except that when you blow it up, again, you apply a lot of voltage, and then you move oxygen back, and again, you reconnect your filament. So it's a rather simple instance of filamentary reconnection. For the more complex systems, and also in some kinds of binaries as well, there is a different mode. So the one that I've been describing so far is a nonpolar case. Here is a nickel oxide, so yet another one, and you see here the nonpolar resistive switch and the filament formation. These are schematic from the review of Akihito Sawa. But there is another mode of resistive switching. And in this case, usually you'll see it in more complex systems, including STO, the cuprates, manganites, etc., which is a bipolar mode. In the bipolar mode, you also have low resistance and high resistance switching, but in order to switch back the system, you have to invert the polarity. So here in this resistive hysteresis loop, you have high resistive state, which at high positive voltage goes to low resistance state, but then in order to switch the system back, you have to invert the polarity and go all the way up here and then regain the state. Since there is polar change, since it's a polar change, what you may think here is that ionic migration is important. So the schematic view here is that oxygen vacancies are being moved to one side and to the other side of the system. So, yes.
I have a question on the filamentary story. So, how do we know that this is actually, like in the copper case, you showed formation of a copper filament, if I understand correctly?
Yes.
As opposed to just having the permanent part for dielectric breakdown?
Well, the yes, dielectric breakdown exists in silicon oxide, and is of course the main issue of degradation of those systems. So in principle, in silicon oxides, you always will generate defects, and when these defects are dense enough, then you'll get your breakdown through the dielectric. The dielectric loses its properties. So in a way, you can think that these things are also defects. The defects can be of different. I just show one case where the defects is just copper. In titanium oxide, you can have Manelli phases which are metallic, so you can have structural changes. But in any case, there are structural changes which improve. The key difference with silicon oxide is that you can undo the thing here. So that's the big difference, and I think it's because transition metal oxides are rather ionic. So you can push back and forth the.
So we should think of this filament as some sort of conduction path. It need not be always, say, pure nickel or pure copper. Or
that's right. No, in the case of pure copper is nice because all other possibilities are insulating. So if there is a metallic thing, it has to be copper. But in titanium oxide, they found Manelli phases connecting. So you can have a structural transition, a chemical transition, electroform in the system, but can be undo. And that is because oxygens can be moved back and forth. And that is nonpolar. So there are percolative conductive paths spanning the two electrodes. In this case, it's not quite clear the same. So here there is some ionic migration involved, which is promoted by the voltage, but really people were more in the dark. So I got more interested into these systems, and I'm going to show you some modeling that we've done and how simple modeling in this apparently impossible, intractable, so universal and diverse problem, even with simple modeling, you can give a useful guidance for experiments. So this is a simple model of bipolar resistive switching. So this is the model. It's introduced for these binary systems, and we call it voltage-enhanced oxygen drift. So basically, I said that the system is quite homogeneous. So we just take a thin slab or section of this system where we're going to consider the conductance through the two electrodes. So we just take a thin piece of it and split this system in cells. And these cells, you can think of nanoscale size, such that each region has a well-defined resistivity. Now, if we are dealing with transition metal oxides, the resistivity will be set, we assume it to be set, by a single variable, which is the concentration of oxygen vacancies. Now, in a conductive oxide, like a manganite or a cuprate, as Antoine has emphasized also before, the conduction takes place through oxygens. So if you take out an oxygen, you break a transition metal oxygen transition metal bond. So that is a very effective disorder center. So the more oxygens you take out, the higher the resistance of these systems will be. So we assume this conduction path being realized by small cells. Each one of these cells will be characterized by some density of oxygen vacancies, which we call delta I. So cell I has this amount of vacancies. Now, given that amount of vacancies, we make a very simple assumption. We said that the more vacancies you have, the more resistance you will have. So because the main effect of them is disorder. We also keep something which has been highlighted by experiments to be important, which is the role of the interfaces. Why? Because in a conductive oxide like a dope manganite or cuprate, you see that most of the resistance in this sandwich structure occurs at the interface where you generate a Schottky barrier. So we keep the barriers, and the only assumption that we're going to make is that the resistance of a given amount of vacancies at the interface will be much more important. So we assume that the proportionality constant A at the interfaces will be many times larger than in the bulk. So you can take, for simplicity, the bulk to be 1 and at the interfaces to be much larger than 1. So now we apply a voltage to this thing. We can apply any voltage protocol. We discretize the time. And then we're going to have a very simple one-dimensional resistor network where the resistance of each one of these cells is given by the concentration of oxygen vacancies. So now we have to explain how the oxygen vacancies will migrate through the system. So we assume that there is a probability to migrate oxygen vacancies under an applied voltage from cell I to neighboring cell B, and the number of vacancies will be proportional to the number of vacancies that you have in A, proportional also to the available space for accommodate vacancies on B, and there will be an exponential factor with some sort of diffusive term, and the promotion of migration will be enhanced by the local voltage drop. So you apply a voltage through this system, you compute all the local voltage drops, so that is the voltage drop, that is the electric force that will push, enhance the drift of the oxygen vacancy from cell to cell. And here is a key feature, because I mentioned this voltage time dilemma. You need to change the system, switch the system in nanoseconds while the memory will be retained for years. And here you have an exponential factor. Somewhere there has to be some exponential in order to be able to achieve this big change of energy scales. So the simulation of these systems can be done very straightforwardly. And we have done that. I'm going to illustrate that with a key experiment. So I've been talking about IV curves. So this is a low resistance, high resistance switching. This is a bimodal system. But this you can translate also in some sort of hysteresis loop in where you transform current voltage to resistance voltage. So when you are in this branch, you are in the low resistance branch, and then you move to the high resistance branch over there. So you get a hysteresis loop that looks more square in the RV. So this phenomenon, which is quite intuitive, translates to this type of hysteresis loop. Now, I was searching to, you know, give more support to this very, very simple model. And I recall in the early days, some very strange results from one of the main groups at the time, Alex Ignatiev from Houston. And in one of his papers and in the talks he gave, he showed this very different R versus V. So this is, it doesn't have axis, but this is the same, R versus V. So you apply positive voltage, negative voltage, and this is the resistive change. So instead of being just this rather intuitive square behavior, he had this thing, which he termed the table with legs, in which you see it's a high resistance there, and then you go to low resistance, and you recover, and then you change the voltage, and nothing happens until suddenly the resistance goes down, and then it recovers. So he pointed out that you have to be very careful. This was a very symmetric system, trying to be very, very simple. It was a manganite with two identical electrodes, and he observed this kind of behavior. And he said, be careful, because if you pole your system very much positive and then suddenly very much negative, it will be jumping from here to here, and you will not see any resistive change. So I said, this is quite weird. I want to know if our model captures that. But before doing that, I convinced some of my experimental colleagues at that time in Buenos Aires, who have done experiments in manganites in the 90s and cuprates even before, to grab their samples from their drawers, which were getting dust, and try to reproduce this data. And they did that, and these are the results that they obtained. These are two different labs, two different groups, manganites and cuprates. And you see that you observe this very nice table with legs with much more detail than in those early experiments. So we went with our model and tried to see if we can capture that. And these are the results we obtained. And we say, wow, that's fantastic. But we didn't understand what was going on. After scratching our heads, this is a very simple simulation. I explained the model to you. So at the end, we find a very simple way to understand this thing. And I'll show you in a moment. So this is what we want to understand, the table with legs, high resistance, low resistance, coming back to high resistance, low resistance. So what do we have? We have a system which is a manganite with two Schottky interfaces. So what happens at one interface cannot be nothing different than a resistive change, because you bring oxygen vacancies in and out from that highly resistive interface. So the interface can just change the resistance up and down. Now, whatever is positive for one interface is negative for the other. So at the other, you have the opposite behavior. So this is left interface, right interface, and they do exactly the opposite. When you add the two, you get there the table with legs. So we get a lot of insight from here. We tell them, listen, everything is happening at the interfaces, and if you make a system very, very, very symmetric, that's going to be bad, because you're going to be moving from here to here, from here to here, and see no resistive change. So it's much better to get a system very asymmetric, make one electrode which is Schottky, the other which is ohmic, and then you're going to have a very high resistive value of just one interface being acting. Yes?
So what's the relation of the green curve with the blue and the...
It's just the sum of the two. If you go and you sum the two, you'll see that it looks like that. And there you can see this, 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 and that. You have there, and then you have the other there. And we've done comparisons with systems which are asymmetric, and everything follows. But I'm running short of time, so I want to cover a bit more of material. So this was some of our earlier work, some 7 years ago. And this is more recent. So this is also, although systems are already, you know, the industry is already moving into the market, there are plenty of interesting physical questions. And I want to show that even fundamental physical questions are interesting. So this is our recent work done in collaboration with the group of Vlad Dobrosalevich. And really everything came out from the work of our students. His student recognized that the model that I described to you actually in the continuum limit sustains shock waves, because you can make a connection to Berger's equations. So I had a lot of fun and learning about nonlinear dynamics, and see that our model predicted shock waves, and many of the simulation results that we did not understand became quite clear under this light. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time to go through that, but I can show you that we predicted some scaling loss from these short waves, which have a very, very simple form. And this is not, you know, totally out in the academic air, because the change in the resistance will link to one time, which is the commutation time, which is of prime importance for experiments. And moreover, we identified that this switching time, scaling time, is connected to parameters of the model. So the parameters of the model are quite physical in the sense that here you have the width of the Schottky barrier and the on-off ratio of the resistance. This is the diffusion constant, D, there. So this already shows you that even very basic physics, which is connecting the migration of oxygen vacancies, forming shock waves, which is a concept of nonlinear dynamics, at the end of the day can be connected to very practical issues of importance for the design of these memories. And of course, all these values for us are just constants, but it will be a great challenge to try to connect these to microscopic theories by density functional calculations or any realistic method that can give more insight.
Marcelo, if you make the two interfaces more asymmetric,
yes,
you can change the shape of this RV hysteretic cycle according to your simulation.
Yes, yes. I could show you some of these things. These are very beautiful because they change in a very specific way, and we capture all the tiny details. But I'm going to leave that for later because I'm worried about running fast. I can try to go there, and it's just the transparency I took out just to be able to be on time. But I'll get it back. Where is that? There. Okay, so this is a second non-trivial test, which is precisely introducing asymmetry. So if you introduce asymmetry, this A constant on the left Schottky barrier and the one in the right Schottky barrier, you can tune it. So the things that I showed before is the perfectly symmetric case, where the ratio of the two is one, two identical Schottky barriers. And there you get the table with the legs. Now we introduce more and more asymmetry, and you see that this thing changes in this peculiar fashion. And if you do the experiment, this is what you get. Again, PCMO and YBCO. And here you see that this thing has this tiny upturn and this little curve. And here you see the upturn there and the little curve, both in the two. This thing and this thing. So when we saw that, we were like, this got to be correct. And of course, you can also understand that from the previous argument. You have a big switching loop there on one interface, the other is smaller, and when you add the two, that's what you get. So this is this was very nice, and I think that it gives, you know, a guidance for experiments, which is the truly nice thing out of this. So let me get back to where I was to say that this story, which seemed to be quite happy, for me was also a big disappointment. Why? Because when I learned about resistive switching from my friend in Norway, when I was depressed in Argentina in the middle of the crisis of 2002, I got very excited and I said, oh, transition metal oxide, resistive switching, this is mod transitions, I love this thing. So I jump into this, but you see, after more than 10 years of work, there's no really strong correlations other than putting oxygen in and out and basically tuning defects. So that was quite a turn-off. So where are the correlation effects? And this is the second part. Usually, second parts are bad. In this case, second part is much better than the first. So we go to this volatile resistive switching. And this occurs in something which is three-dimensional mod insulators. So this goes by the sexy title of modtronics. So what is a mod system? Well, Antoine has described it before. I'm just going to put a little bit of that in the present context. So a mod system is a system that should be metal, but in reality turns out to be an insulator. And sometimes you can tune a metal insulator transition without any magnetism playing any role. These are two paramagnetic states. This is temperature, and this is applied pressure on the very famous compound V2O3. So this is a first order line with a lot of hysteresis, which means that there are phases in competition. The metallic phase and the insulating phase are almost degenerate in energy, competing to, and that has, of course, dramatic effects on the transport properties of the system. So this famous compound got a lot of insight by the development in the 90s of DMFT. I don't need to emphasize the importance of DMFT here. It's like preaching to the choir. So this is the results of the Haber model, early results of the Haber model as a function of correlation U, and you see realize the metal insulator transition as you increase the value of U. So as you do that, what you see is that you get quasi-particles, which are narrower and narrower, heavier masses, as Antoine has also mentioned. The effect of correlation U is to enhance the value of the effective mass, and then suddenly at an intermediate value of U, when the potential energy dominates on top of the kinetic energy, you create a more insulator. Now, one of the big surprises of this DMFT studies was that if you come from the insulator, you can decrease the value of U and find a region where you still have the two Haber bands and an insulator where before you had a metal. So what I'm saying here is that for some intermediate values of U, there is actually coexistence. You have two states that can be stabilized in the system. In the same way that in a ferromagnet, you can have an upspin or a downspin state for the same values of the parameters, same J, same temperature. You can have up and down, two possible solutions. Here you have two possible solutions, a metal and an insulator. So if I do, as for magnets, temperature versus we can put here interaction, U, you can see that this is pure metal, this is pure insulator, low values of U, high values of U, and in between you have this triangular coexistent region with two spinodal lines, and there you see the free energy changing, dominating one or the other solution. So the key point here is that there is competition of phases, coexistence, and more important in our context is that these states have a very different transport property. Very large change in resistance, which is where we are after. So the question I want to pose is, what happened to this insulating system, which should be metallic, but it turns out to be insulator? If you do density functional, should be metals, but turn out to be insulators. And now you try to drive a current through them. You apply a strong voltage, and you try to destabilize that insulating state, which is competing there with the metal, and somehow won. So basically what I'm doing is I'm trying to mix mod physics with electronics. This is motronics, or fundamental physics terms, applying strong electric fields to mod systems. Very good. So this is the experiment. So in this experiment, you apply voltage, strong voltage. This is done in a bulk system of GTS, which we study in great detail, and it's a beautiful example of a three-dimensional mod system that does not order. And I'll be very happy to give you details on this work. So this is a single crystal. It's not dope. It's just a stoichiometric, and it works like a charm. So here we apply, since we have bulk, we have to apply a strong voltage. This is 40 volts applied to this 100 micrometer or so sample. And what you see is that this is the applied voltage. It spans 100 microseconds. And what you observe is that the voltage on the sample, the voltage that actually, here you have the circuit. So you apply the voltage, and you have the sample, and some low resistance to avoid the sample from burning. So you see the voltage on the sample is here in light blue. So what you see is that the voltage on the sample suddenly goes down at 89 microseconds, collapses to a very low value. What you see is that this insulating system, which had a very low current, suddenly, as the voltage collapses, it allows a huge spike of current go through it. And why is that? Because the resistance has collapsed by almost two orders of magnitude, from 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 2, and you see here the collapse of the resistance as a function of time.
distinguishing between two different local minima.
That's right. That's a very important. That's right. That's a very important point. While before, we worried about the reproducibility because basically we were tuning defects, so we were having structural changes. Here, this experiment is perfectly reproducible. You can do it 10,000 times, or my collaborators at NANT, the group of Laurent Cariot, can do it 10,000 times, and it will have data one on top of the other. So this is highly reproducible.
So the time scale of 100 microseconds is set by what?
We're going to get to that. Let me to get in a minute. So this is very interesting. This is volatile resistance change. So here we have a longer time after the pulse in a semi-log scale. Here is log-log scale. Here is semi-log scale. And you see that after the pulse, we observe the resistance to recover. And it recovers in about a millisecond. So we have a very fast collapse and then a slower recovery. And this process is perfectly reproducible. So there is no migration. There is no ionic migration. Presumably so, but we're going to have more insights into that. And also more questions, more than answers. OK, before getting into that, I want to show something which is also quite spectacular. So this is this GTS system that probably nobody, not many people know about. It's a chalcogenide. I'm telling you, it's a fantastic compound. And here we have a systematic behavior of the voltage on the sample as a function of time. And you see, as before, at 40 volts, this system collapses in microseconds. If you apply higher voltage, it collapses fastest. If you apply less voltage, it takes longer and longer time. And then there is a threshold, about 10 volts, where you're not going to see the system collapsing its resistance at all. So you can systematize all this into this IV curve, where this is the initial voltage on the sample. So in the experiment before, we apply 40 volts initially up there. And then after a while, the resistance collapses and the current boosts in this spike up to there. So this is the initial voltage. This is the final voltage. This is the initial current. And this is the final current. So you see the collapse of the voltage and the increase of the current, initial and final. Okay, so this is showing you the collapse of. And you see quite clearly there there is a voltage threshold at 10 volts. And above that, you have very, very nice voltage regulation. For all these currents, you have always the same voltage. Now, the spectacular thing is that you do that in another chalcogenide, which has nothing to do with that. It's a famous case. Also, nickel sulfur selenide is also known as a 3D MOD system with a first order line separating a paramagnetic insulator and a paramagnetic metal, with hysteresis and everything, and you get same behavior. And even more spectacular, instead of chalcogenide, now we have an oxide, the famous V2O3, doped with chromium, which makes the system insulating. So at low temperatures, an insulating antiferromagnet, and at high temperatures, an insulating paramagnet, but it's always insulating, so there is no possibility of, by just heating, getting a transition, as could be the case, for instance, in VO2, which is a different story. So here you see that all these systems, 3D systems, very different, they behave quite similarly, with collapses in microseconds and very nice voltage regulation, similar thresholds. And this is the electric field threshold. This is not the voltage threshold, but an electric field, because you can just take different samples of different sizes and see what is the threshold, and you find out the scaling gives you the important feature is an electric field, and you see there is kilovolt per centimeter. And then you wonder, where is this kilovolt per centimeter coming from? Yes? There is no structural transition. No. So let's try to see what we know as theorists about the collapse of MOD systems. So in a schematic view, you have sites in your lattice. These are all the lattice sites. The sites will be mostly singly occupied. That is why you have a system which is localized, which is an insulator. It's half filled, so you have one electron sitting per side with some disordered spin state. And then you're going to have a lower Haber band separated of to an upper Hubble bound by a fraction of an electron volt or so. That's a Mott gap. And then when you put the system into a field, what you do is you tilt the bands, the insulating bands. So you have a high potential on one side, a low potential on the other. So the bands get tilted, and the amount of tilting is the electric field. So in a Mott insulator, it's a quantum mechanical system. The electrons are not perfectly localized. They can extend. They go wander around and come back. That is the correlation length of these excitations, which are called doublons. Of course, they cannot delocalize through the system because you're going to have a metal. All these things have a finite correlation length, which is called psi. So the key point here would be that in order to destroy this insulator state, you have to tilt the bands strongly enough so that this gap is overcome in a length psi. So the moment this thing can hop up to this site, already finds the upper Hubble band, which is totally empty, and then it can zoom. So at that point, you're going to have the collapse of the insulating state. This can be investigated in one-dimensional systems, which are highly tractable, so you can ask all type of questions. Unfortunately, our experiments are in three-dimensional systems, and we know that 3D is quite different from 1D. Nevertheless, there's a lot of theoretical work being done along these lines, and in particular, dynamical mean field theory out of equilibrium is a very hot topic as well, and we would love to be able to do this kind of studies right at the coexistence regime. That is still a little bit of a challenge, but hopefully we're going to get there. In any case, there you have the electric field that has to be the critical electric field, the threshold electric field, has to go as the Mott gap divided by the correlation length of this doublon psi. So in 1D, you know this all the properties, and you know that the inverse psi or psi goes as the inverse Mott gap. The higher gap, the shorter this length. So if you plug it in here, you'll find that the threshold field will be going as the Mott gap square, and you can check that by simulations. Unfortunately, one dimension doesn't give us a lot of detail, but already is telling us that this is the things to take into account. But now there is a big problem. Why? Because if we want to consider this scaling for our system, we have a Mott gap is a fraction of the electron volt in these systems. And then what number would you like to put for this decorrelation length, correlation length of these doublons? So I don't know, a reasonable number may be a nanometer, like a few lattice spacing. So a nanometer is 10 to the minus 7 centimeters. And then if you take the ratio, what you get is that the threshold field should be a megavolt per centimeter. And that is compared very poorly with the threshold of a kilovolt per centimeter that we observe in these three different systems. So a naive Haber model will give you a prediction which is several orders of magnitude off. Also, the times involved in the collapse of a Haber model driven out of equilibrium will be very fast, femtoseconds or so, and here we see microseconds, which is consistent to the fact that the field is very low, but it's sort of inconsistent with all our theoretical predictions. So this is just to mention that there is something to be added into the Haber model, although, of course, all these lines of work are important. So what I'm going to do now is just take a very humble approach, and as I did before, also introduce a phenomenological model, which will give us quite a bit of insight. Very good. So this is a new phenomenological model. It's also a resistor network. This is a two-dimensional resistor network. But it, in contrast to the one before, it has inspiration from the MFT. So this is what we are after. We want to capture this type of physics. And this is the resistor network that we have. So resistor networks are of many size and shapes. Everything boils down to what are the assumptions that you make for your resistive units. So the specific assumptions we're going to make here is the following. We're going to assume that there is a landscape in where you have two solutions, the stable mod insulator and a metastable correlated metal, and this is suggested by the MFT. These two solutions are separated by a potential barrier, which is EB there. So the system will be mostly in this state initially because we are dealing with a mod insulator, and then it will have some probability to each one of these cells to be promoted by thermal fluctuations to the correlated metal. Now, of course, once in the correlated metal, this is metastable, so it will have a high probability to relax back. Clearly, when you don't apply any voltage, anything that has been excited will relax back, so you have a volatile state. Okay, so there is one more assumption that I don't want to put under the rug, and is the following. Of course, the mod insulating cells will have a much higher resistance than the correlated metal ones. When are insulating, they are metallic. But the probability of transition from one state to the other is not going to be dictated only by the barrier from insulator to metal, but we're going to make an additional assumption, which I think is quite reasonable, and is that the probability is enhanced by the local voltage drop. So the higher the field on a cell, the higher the probability of going from insulator to metal. Once you're in the metal, of course, there is no voltage drop because it's highly conductive. So here we just have the value of this energy here of this metastable state and the barrier. So the relaxation from this back is basically a constant value. Of course, it's thermally activated. And this, in this case, it is a big barrier which can be modulated by the applied voltage. OK, so this is the sole assumption. We apply a voltage protocol. We separate it in discrete time steps. We have to solve for the voltage drops through the whole cell and then do some Monte Carlo simulation where each one of these cells may change. So this is the experiments that I was describing. These are the theoretical results. So you see that this is the voltage on the sample divided by the threshold. So all these values are above 1. And you see that the higher the voltage on the sample, the quicker the transition occurs, like in the experiment. And then at very long times, you have an asymptotic value. This asymptotic value is reflected here on the fact that this system has a perfect voltage regulation. So you see this is the high resistive state. This state's over there before the transition. And then after the transition, the system goes to values which are different currents so that to have always the same applied voltage, which is the threshold. And this is very sort of easy to understand after you see a little movie that will give you a bit of intuition of what's going on. So this is a simulation of the resistive transition. And what you see, I'm going to stop it for a second there just to explain. So this is the two-dimensional cell. All the white spots are insulator. The voltage drop is quite homogeneous because the full system is homogeneous. And the applied voltage is here depicted in green. So there is a moderate value of voltage. Some cells randomly go thermally activated to metal. So this is a metallic cell, excited. And in a metallic cell, we see that the voltage drop goes down to 0. So this blue is 0. Blue is cold. Red is hot. So this is 0 voltage. And then you'll see, after a while, that some structures start to appear. And you're going to get a very dramatic change. So these are metallic sites, which are look dilute. But if the rate, the applied voltage is strong enough, the rate of formation of these things overcome the relaxation, and suddenly you see such a dramatic filamentary formation. If the voltage is very high, this sole filament will not be enough to reduce the resistance of your system, and you can have more filamentary formation, and the filament formation will go on and on and on until the voltage on the sample goes down beneath the voltage threshold, and there it stops. So that's why there is a perfect voltage regulation.
Oh, sorry.
Yes?
What is the square with the little blue dots inside?
Each one of these sites are the cells of the system. Mm-hmm. So they are all white, they are all insulating. When they become dark, they become metallic. Okay. And as you see, they can relax back.
But there are squares which are, let's say, light blue with some...
That's right. The
spot inside, right? No?
No, they are not light blue with the blue. There are even light blue there with white. So what you do have is that on different sites, you may have different colors because the voltage is not homogeneous. So these are snapshots from the transition we've seen. So how does the transition nucleates? It nucleates when you have a high probability of creating defects. This is defects that can heal themselves. These are metallic defects. And if the rate of production is higher than the rate of relaxation, eventually, you're going to have some clusters. When you have some clusters, something, an avalanche occurs in the sense that you have a metallic filament here, and then your voltage drop will be enhanced at the tip of the filament. This voltage drop will enhance the probability of these sites to turn metallic. So you have it there. And the more this thing grows, the stronger it will be. Now you see red already, red and red, and this spans out, so you see that this thing grows to the sides, and this thing reaches to the other side in a very dramatic event, where you get it there, and everything now is metallic. Now, once this is metallic there, the system realizes that this is now a thin filament, so all the voltage drop is dropping here compared to that, so the direction of the phase change occurs on the other direction, and then you have some relaxation there until this filament becomes quite homogeneous. But important and very different from all what I said before and what happens in conventional silicon oxide is that these defects that render the system metallic, bridging between the two electrodes, then they relax back, and you get exactly the same compound. So this is like an elastic instead of a plastic deformation of the system, and that's the beauty of this MOT property. Very nice.
It's kind of an avalanche phenomenon.
It's like a runaway avalanche phenomenon. But then it just relax itself. Very well. After so much excitement, one may say, is this really a good model? And then, of course, you have lots of worries. So I said, let's try to think about a key experiment that can sort of bring us some confidence that this is right. And what is the key ingredient that we put there? Which sets this MOT physics aside of all what I've said before, is this assumption of the existence of this metastable state metallic that you can access by pushing the system out of its equilibrium, out of this insulating state. But this relaxation has introduced a key new time scale into the problem, which was not before. So can we probe that thing? And the idea is, let's apply pulses. So these pulses are very strong, but they are very short. They are shorter than the time you need in order to system for collapse. So we apply very short pulses. So we apply a short pulse, and then we wait. We let the system recover, and then we apply another one, which is also short. Clearly, if the time between these pulses is very, very long, you're never going to have a transition, because each one of the pulses is not strong enough, and the system fully recovers. Now, in the other extreme, if this tau is very, very short, basically you are applying a constant pulse. So you're damaging the system, pop, 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 and you're going to have the transition. So this is a simulation. And what we predict is that if this time is comparable, is longer than this relaxation time, you're not going to see a transition. You can do this systematically in simulations and see that when the time between these pulses is very, very short, you just need to accumulate the pulses to reach the collapse time. But if you start separating them, you need more because you allow the system to partially recover. So you need to keep on doing that. And if your time is very long, this is taking just too many pulses. And there is a well-defined threshold beyond which you will not have any switching. So here you see transition after 5 pulses. So these were simulations done with Pablo Stolyar, and then he went to Nantes to try this in the experimental system, GTS, as I mentioned before. And these are his experimental results. So you see here, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, and then suddenly you have the collapse. So the system is not changing its resistance, or it's changing a little bit, probably because of some thermal effect, but then you have a sudden collapse. And if you do, and after that, of course, the system remains collapsed. And if you do this in a systematic fashion, you see the longer the time in between the pulses, the more and more you need. And then beyond a certain time delay, which is about a millisecond, which goes nicely with the initial results that I showed you, although the initial results have been done after the thing, was a good validation of the thing as well. Here we probe the relaxation time from this state. The exciting thing is that was the realization that this thing can serve as a functioning neuron. And this is what I'm going to tell you in a moment. So I mentioned about the neurons, the preneurons and the postneurons. So one neuron integrates pulses that arrive to its dendrites from neighboring neurons. And then if that amount of excitation is strong enough, the neuron just fires a pulse. So here we can associate our pulses to, here you have, this is a bio, from biology, from any biology journal. You see these are spikes arriving to a neuron. This is measured. So this is the action potentials and all these things from biology, where you see all these amount of spikes reaching a neuron. And if these things are frequent enough and strong enough, then it will create a neuron to send an action potential down its axon to communicate the information to the next neuron. So we associate these spikes to these short pulses in our system. And then what you see here is that it's another instance of what I showed. This is now voltage, and this is current. So it's not the collapse of the resistance, but the collapse of the resistance was linked to the spike in current. So here it shows that after 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 pulses, at the last one, we have a sudden collapse of the resistance and the concomitant spike in the current. And here you see the neuron spiking. Now, if this thing works as a neuron, then if we increase the frequency, so we keep the features of the characteristic of the pulses, the 20 microseconds, constant, and we make them more frequent, that we knew from our previous work, that with less number of spikes, you're going to get the firing of the neuron. And if you make that stronger, we also knew it because that reduced the time for firing. You make this system stronger pulses, and you see with 4 pulses with respect to that. So this is 30 microseconds. We just enlarge the T on, so we enlarge the weight of this spike, and we see with 4 fires, it works. And this can be really put in a good context, making a good analogy with biological neurons, at least of one type, which is a classic one, which is the leaky integrate and fire neuron. This is called the leaf neuron, and it's one of the canonical models of neurobiology. So this is the model, the model of the leaf neuron, where you have some membrane potential and, you know, the partial differential equation with the time and a resistor and a capacitor and so on, and the spikes arriving. And we can just make a one-to-one correspondence to our model, where, for instance, the membrane potential, which controls when the neuron gets to the threshold and fires, here corresponds to the number of sites that are transformed into the density of the metallic sites. So we have a similar differential equations, similar behavior, and interestingly enough, we can find a close analytic form, since the model is simple, of how many pulses you need in order to fire. And this is just as a function of the size of the pulses, that is the on-off time of the pulses, and the relaxation time, intrinsic relaxation time of the system. So with that formula, we went to test it into experiments, and this is a systematic test of how this leaky integrate and fire neuron works, and this has been translated into a patent, which I'm happy it's my first patent. I never expected all this mod system to be useful for anything. Okay. With this, I want to conclude. So the summary. We now have artificial synapses and artificial neurons made of simple two-terminal oxide devices. The physics of these systems is rooted in this effect of resistive switching. So I showed you with these two examples that I described, the theoretical modeling, although this problem seems complex in a sense that it's so varied and so many different compounds and effects, still we can do some basic, even phenomenological theoretical modeling and provide useful guidance for experiments. And I think that the most exciting message is that now the way is open for neuromorphic applications. So here you have some references to reviews. There are many on non-volatile resistive switching, which is well established, and there is much less on the more exciting volatile thing. And I just want to put the name of my collaborators through these years, in particular the group in Nantes of Laurent Cariot, Etienne Chanot, and Benoit Coras, and also Pablo Stolier, who is now with Isao Inoue in Tsukuba, and the collaborators also in Buenos Aires, led by Pablo Levy. And thank you very much.